This was a woman who famously said, I don't get out of bed for under $10,000 a day. But the last 5 years have bankrupted her soul. Linda Evangelista, now 56 years old, has been in hiding after a botched cosmetic procedure left her horribly disfigured. She signed up for something called Cool Sculpting, a common non-invasive procedure that you can get at the dermatologist's office. But within a few months, the places on her body where she wanted smaller, like her back and her neck and her thighs, they all became a whole lot bigger and harder and numb. This is a photo that she gave exclusively to People magazine, where you can see some of the damage that she points to at her bra line. And when she asked her doctor if these deformities could be fixed, the soul-crushing answer was no. Thus began her legal battle against the company behind Cool Sculpting, and tonight her public campaign to show people what happened to her can happen to anyone. Joining us now is Francesca Bacardi. She's the Page Six chief reporter for the New York Post. Francesca, thanks for being with us. Why do you suppose Linda is emerging now, 5 years after she went into hiding, ashamed to have anyone even look at her?
Thanks for having me. I think she's finally found confidence in herself and her story and is stepping out into the spotlight to shed a light not only on what can happen with Cool Sculpting, but also warn others against the process that, like you said, is very common. She now is looking to reclaim her sense of self. Like, she was a famous supermodel, the most famous supermodel, but she's been in hiding for years, and now she's sort of reclaiming that narrative. She wants to own her story. She said in the People magazine article that she once graced all the catwalks, and now she's afraid to run into anybody at the supermarket. But now, with the help of this lawsuit and this photo shoot and giving these interviews, she's changing the narrative.
So the reality is that she wanted, you know, to slim down in a couple of places, like the neck area, the inner thighs, and you saw the bra part. That's the photo she's releasing to us. But this had the opposite effect. I mean, it literally, the places where she treated got huge, and it's not small. Like, these are really significant, even for a supermodel, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The company has come out and said less than 1% of people experience this adverse reaction, which is called PAH. And what happens is, instead of the area reducing, it has the opposite effect. Everything swells up and becomes hard, and the areas become swollen. Now, the only solution to this is to undergo full body liposuction, which she did. And once again, she had an adverse reaction. The liposuction didn't take. She went again for liposuction, and the areas just continued to swell.
And in some of these procedures, I understand even liposuction won't work because these sort of large masses get quite hard and then can't be, you know, suctioned out. The suit, holy cow, Francesca, it's $50 million. I'm curious about the figure. She's 50, you know, 6 years old now, so she doesn't have the supermodel career ahead of her that she used to. Where does she come up with the $50 million mark?
Well, for someone who didn't get out of bed for less than $10,000 a day, I think she is basing off of all lost opportunities. I mean, yes, she is older and she retired in 2001, but she had been making sporadic appearances as part of beauty campaigns, magazine covers. So there's no definite number on what her career has lost out on as a result of this reclusive lifestyle. But I think she's also suing not only for the money lost professionally, but also emotional damages. She said she had succumbed to depression unlike any other. She didn't want to get out of bed. So there's an absolute emotional component to this large figure that she's come up with.
Yeah, I mean, when you go from being a supermodel to being you know, afraid to even show your face, there's a certain amount of pain and suffering, I think, that you could definitely, you know, measure on that one. So this is the other kind of gossipy question, and that is that Cindy Crawford has come out supportive of Linda Evangelista, but not a lot of others. And she was notoriously the bad girl of modeling. She was difficult, rumored to be troublesome and brazen and rude and, you know, all of those adjectives. So I'm sort of curious, what's the fashion world saying? Are they weighing in on support of her? Is anybody coming to her aid, or are people snickering behind her back and saying karma, which would be nasty no matter what?
Well, privately facing, I can't really speak to what they're whispering, but publicly facing, everybody, of course, is going to come out and comment on her Instagram, because that's the bare minimum of what you can do. Designers such as Isaac Mizrahi, Marc Jacobs, models such as Christy Turlington, Naomi Campbell, Polina Portskova, other members of the Magnificent Seven have come out and expressed their support for her, calling her brave, all of those social media buzzy adjectives to sort of highlight and support what she's going through. Now, as for what they're saying behind her back and the people who have had to work with her and experienced difficulties, you can only speculate, but on her Instagram, people are absolutely showing support, because it is such a difficult thing to go through. You know, there's this taboo about aging gracefully. Nobody wants to do it, specifically women, and she tries to buy her way into, you know, fighting that aging, fighting the natural weight gain, and instead she was cursed in a way. I mean, she's described herself as deformed. So, of course, publicly, various supermodels and designers are lauding her and her bravery for coming out and not only talking about it, but showing these massive lumps, you know, on her back and her legs. It's really incredible.
Yeah, and it's, you know, fully in People magazine. You can take a look and see some of the other photos that are exclusive to the magazine. But Francesca Vicardi, thanks very much for helping us sort through this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So joining me now with insight into how this happens, how big the risk is if you're thinking about cool sculpting and what can be done about it, is Dr. Andrew Orden. He's a board-certified plastic surgeon and host of The Doctors. And also joining me, Valerie Greenberg. She's a lifestyle and entertainment expert. Welcome to both of you. Dr. Andrew Orden, I'm going to begin with you if I can. Hello. You know, most people think of The cool sculpting is the non-invasive, you know, the easy, the simple, that you can just get it done in the doctor's office. You know, you don't have to go under the knife. They think of it as the safe approach. But I don't think a lot of people know that it can be life-ending if looks are your life.
Well, number one, great to be back with you, Ashley, as always. And you're absolutely right. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably isn't. And it is such an easy sell, saying that you can come in, have these paddles attached to your body. You lie there comfortably. It freezes your fat. The fat breaks down. The body absorbs that dead fat tissue. And those, quote, figure faults that you had are gone. But I don't use the technology in my office. I know a lot of colleagues who do. I'm an old-fashioned liposuction guy. I believe that that's the tried and true best way to remove unwanted fat. And although millions of people have had cool sculpting, you know, there are some downsides with it. I have seen this type of situation where you get this paradoxic recurrence of fat, lumps of fat, hard fat, that are very, very difficult to correct.
I mean, it is the exact opposite of what you're trying to cure. It actually becomes, you know, more significant.
That's why I feel so bad for Linda. She had the best of intentions. I'm sure she felt very comfortable in the scenario she was in and expected to have these figure faults fixed. And she ended up coming out worse. And, you know, it comes down to informed consent. Was she informed that you may regrow fat like this and that may necessitate further surgery, more invasive surgery involving general anesthesia, more invasive than the first procedure? So it comes down to whether she was fully informed of the risks and complications. That's a huge part of this case.
Sure, that's the small print, right? I mean, whenever you go in for any procedure, you sign so many documents, and very few people read through, you know, even their iPhone agreement, but this is serious stuff. Well, I want to actually just play something, Dr. Orton, if I can, that she said, because at this point, you know, hearing her voice is so critical if people are thinking about, you know, doing something like this. This is what Linda Evangelista told People magazine. Have a listen.
When I first started Cool Sculpting, I thought it would be advantageous for me personally and professionally. Did I want to like what I saw in the mirror, you know, or I was offered this tool to fine tune it and I drank the magic potion.
Valerie, the magic potion in looking better in the mirror and liking what she saw, that's where my heart just broke, because I grew up looking at her, right? I mean, you're a beautiful woman. I would say the same thing about you. Don't change a thing.
Thank you so much.
Linda Evangelista, I would never imagine she'd want to change anything.
So she is literally the absolute ideal of perfection. I know she was jaw-droppingly beautiful, Ashley. And the fact that she sort of dug herself in this hole and, you know, is up against so many difficult situations, you know, health-wise right now, it's really terrible, because not only did she describe all of the aesthetics that she has to deal with, but this is actually causing her pain. She's talked about chafing. I mean, when you go in for Cool Sculpting, you're not thinking that that's what's going to happen. You want to fine tune and remove that 20% extra fat in those areas, in the spots that are difficult. And listen, it's so readily available. You know, living in the streets of New York City, it's available at every single med spa. And it just seems like the normal thing to do. But the fact of the matter is, this can happen. And again, you said fine print, and it's just devastating. But I love the fact that she's sort of trying to take all of the blocks and weights off her shoulders and say, listen, I'm going through this and I'm going to share it with the world, because I can't hide anymore. The hiding is suffering for her. And she, to me, that is beautiful, the fact that she wants to make a difference like this. But it's just mind blowing what happened to her. It's out of control. You would never in a million years think this would happen.
Like the average person who doesn't make a living, you know, being seen, being looked at, being scrutinized, the average person would struggle with saying, let me show you how awful this looks. And there she is. She's doing it. Dr. Orton, I want to just give a quick note to what Cool Sculpting has said. They gave a comment to People magazine, and they said this. Procedure has been well studied, with more than 100 scientific publications and more than 11 million treatments performed worldwide. Rare side effects like PAH, that's the condition, continue to be well documented in the Cool Sculpting information for patients and healthcare providers. So I'm going to give you a two-part question, and that is, does that cover it? Good enough? I mean, how many patients do you know who have something happen that's in the fine print and still prevail in court to the tune of 50 mil? And then number two, if anybody out there is thinking, I still want to do this, what's the risk? You know, what's the actual number risk? Like, how rare is this condition?
Well, it's definitely a rare complication. I have seen it in my office where people say, I've had multiple treatments of Cool Sculpting and either it didn't work, or to a certain degree, the fat grew back. So it can happen. And again, you know, this is a known complication. Although it's rare, they're saying 1%, less than 1%, it's something that needs to be addressed in an informed consent. And also that in certain cases, you may need liposuction under general anesthesia to correct problems related to it. So it's going to come down to whether that was presented to her. And, you know, as somebody who's done a lot of liposuction over decades and fat transfers, and we now have techniques using laser and ultrasound to contract the skin, we can always make things better in a situation like this. Will they be perfect? No. And you know, getting back to the point, Linda Evangelista was used to having a body that she was comfortable running around in a thong. And age, things change. We accumulate fat. We all do hormonal changes. she didn't like it. So this sounded like a great option for her, an easy option, and it didn't work out. So finally, to your last question, as a consumer out there, do your homework. Yes, look into the other techniques available to get rid of fat. You can freeze fat. You can heat and melt fat. And finally, classical, tried, true liposuction has come a long, long way. You need to get multiple opinions and be
all with their own risks, you know, all with their own risks.
There's always risks to all of these things. Got to wrap it there. Make the decision. Is it worth taking that risk?
It's true. Dr. Andrew Warden, thank you. Valerie Greenberg, thank you. Appreciate both of your perspective.
Thank
I want to bring in someone now who knows intimately what it's like to look in the mirror and not see what everybody else sees. Cheryl Burke is a professional dancer. You know her. She's from Dancing with the Stars, 24 seasons, I think, now I'm counting.
25.
Cheryl suffers from body, 25. I knew I was out by a season or so. It's hard to count when it gets up into the sky, you know, scrapers like that. So, Cheryl, I don't know that a lot of people know this, but you suffer from body dysmorphic disorder. You've been public about it. It's a condition where a patient fixates on perceived defects or flaws. I can hear the echo of all of our viewers right now saying, Cheryl Burke has no flaws at all. So I sort of thought of you as somebody who might be able to give a little insight, you know, into the Linda Evangelista story, because not many people saw any flaws with her either.
You know, I applaud her so much for being courageous enough to tell her story, because it's not easy. There's a lot of shame and guilt behind, you know, for me, at least I can say, for having body dysmorphia. I have to say it stems, I think, from being in the spotlight, but also prior to that, being, you know, a competitive ballroom dancer and maybe not looking like everybody, having curves like I do, you know, having a womanly figure that, you know, honestly, I can't control, you know, the size of my hips or whatever it is. And, you know, I still struggle with it to this day. I, you know, will never forget as if it was yesterday when I got criticized for gaining a few pounds a few years ago, and that being everywhere in you know, the magazines, news channels, and talking about, you know, is Cheryl too fat for television? And that, to me, I feel like I'm still going through PTSD. And there's not a day I look at myself in the mirror and I'm like, well, maybe I can lose a little bit more fat here or wherever. You know, it's an actual problem. And I think about it too much, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I'm with you. I do too. I'm not going to lie. I think when you're just constantly looked at, it's hard not to see what might not be good to look at, especially if we're just sort of fixated and you know, exacerbating what might not really be there. So let me ask you this, because I think a lot of people watching right now, they know that they see flaws in themselves as well, and they want to fix that, you know, spot here with a Spanx here and a Spanx there. But when does it go from, like, you know, a concern to a condition?
Well, for me, I knew the pattern was when I was bringing a scale with me whenever I would travel, right? I got so obsessed with the number, and it would kind of dictate my mood in a way. I would see if I gained a pound, if I didn't lose a pound, it was constantly on my mind. And if I didn't lose weight, even if it was just 1 pound, it would ruin my day. And also, I think really being intentional about when you look at yourself in the mirror, what are you saying to yourself? What is that inner voice in your head saying? Are you being critical? Are you being negative? Are you giving yourself enough compassion going into whatever it is that you're doing? You know, comparison is definitely the devil. I mean, that is also what's really hard for me in the dancing world, because, you know, here we are dancing half naked on television, as you guys just saw. And, you know, I can't help but fixate on, oh, is there a back roll in the back of my back? And age comes into play. Like, I'm no longer the youngest pro anymore. So, like, that for me was a condition. Like, it was a constant insecurity. And it would, once it dictates your mood and it basically just takes over your whole train of thought, then you know that there is a problem.
Let me ask you, you're younger than I am by a long shot. So I don't know that you had the same teenage obsession with Linda Evangelista, but I just, like Paulina Poroskova, I just looked at these women, like I'm sure other people older than me looked at Sophia Loren. Just they could not be more perfect and more beautiful than to see this, you know, this exclusive in People magazine broke my heart for her. I wonder how you felt when you heard about her battle.
Oh my gosh, my heart goes out to her and her family. I know how hard it is to talk about something like this, but I just applaud her, as I said earlier, of just how courageous she is, because she really is making me, especially me, feel like I'm not alone. And, you know, my heart goes out to Linda. And look, you know, at the end of the day, you may look perfect from the outside, but you just never know how that person is feeling from the inside.
Yeah, I'm going to ask our control room to do me a favor, because there's something I just noticed in one of the shots I want to ask you about. I didn't really think about it before.
Okay.
It's the cover of People magazine. It's the cover where Linda's on the front, and she's featured prominently on the front of the magazine. Mm-hmm. But look up in the top right-hand corner. It's Anderson Cooper. And yeah. I'm going to ask you about this because I worked with Anderson. I'm a friend of Anderson's. I adore Anderson. Anderson and I are almost exactly the same age, 54. Mm-hmm. He's turning 55 this year. I'll be 55. At the end of the year.
Oh, you look
and
great.
All I keep thinking, well, smoke and mirrors, girl. If you could see the light show going on here. But, you know, it just brings to mind the idea that we're both people in television, and it is a lot harder for people my age to get these jobs than it is for people Anderson's age when you're a boy, you know? You hit your stride in your 40s and 50s when you're a man, and when you're a woman, you better start looking for, you know, a supplementary income. And I just want to know from your perspective, again, being a lot younger than me, as you come into this industry, do you worry that it's short-lived and far more short-lived for you? Is it getting better for your generation than, say, my generation?
Unfortunately, no. You know, I, as a dancer, as a woman, being a ballroom dancer, normally you retire in your early 30s at the latest. And when men age in the ballroom industry, you are, again, like what you said, you know, you are celebrated. And there's not one day or one season after all the 25 seasons I've done, have I asked myself, or have I even said to people that I've been doing interviews with, like, this is my last season. I can no longer do this anymore. There is just this stigma out there that women need to retire by their late 30s or whatever industry you're in, but especially in the Hollywood business, right? And so at the end of the day, though, you've got people like J-Lo celebrating her 50th and looking so amazing. And it's women who celebrate their age and don't, you know, fixate on it, that just truly, you know, that they're so happy from the inside, and that makes them so beautiful from the outside. So I think you're gorgeous regardless. And I don't think
right
that there
you.
Is any... And I think, you know, it just started. Life has just started. If anything, we should celebrate the experience that we've had over the years, you know?
Well, it drives me bananas, because in my business, you're supposed to be smart. And when I was in my 20s and 30s, I was a moron, and yet seemingly
right?
more valuable, right? So that makes me mad. And it also brings to light the adjectives that I heard all growing up when, you know, a man like Clark Gable went, you know, screaming across the screen, he was debonair. But when an older
right.
woman did, she was an old bag. And that just, you know, really, you
it's
never
horrible.
Really shake that stuff as a girl. So, hey,
no,
thanks for coming on, and thanks for being so candid. And I hope I get to meet you in person sometime, because I just think you're the bee's knees.
Oh, I would love that. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much, Cheryl Burke. Appreciate it. Welcome back. It is February 16th, almost spring in some parts of the country. So have you seen your first robin yet? If not, be patient, still early, but be thankful that you haven't gone through what I'm about to show you. In a quiet little neighborhood, folks there just minding their business when literally out of the blue this happened. Blackbirds falling out of the sky by the thousands, all at once in a virtual downpour of death. This is a town in northern Mexico, more or less on the flight path of the migratory yellow-headed blackbird. And this is what the streets of that town looked like on the morning of February 7th, littered with carcasses. Every one of them a little clue to a mystery that has yet really to be solved. Man, just crazy. Enter our detective, Nat Seavey. He's the director of migration science for the National Audubon Society. Nat, thanks so much for being here. First question, it's an easy one. What happened?
Well, that's actually a tougher question than it might seem. And it's certainly something that the local experts are going to be spending some time. You know, whenever there's an event like this, certainly it takes a lot of work to look really into the details about everything that went on there. And without seeing everything that happened, you know, we can only take sort of a guess at what might have happened. But certainly there's some interesting things to see in this video.
Yeah. Okay. So some of the theories that are circling out there, and you're going to have to be the arbiter of all of this, 5G cell phone towers, maybe power lines. This one was interesting. Pesticide tainted wood that's burned for heating. Does any of that sound legit, or could it be something as simple as predatory birds chasing them?
Yeah, well, certainly there's all sorts of things out in the environment that pose a threat to birds, and that's one of the things that makes this so challenging. So one of the things that's unique about this particular species and a number of other related species like blackbirds and starlings is that they form these incredibly dense flocks. And a lot of people might be familiar with some of the videos of these incredibly dense flocks that wheel around in the air. They're called murmurations, and they're absolutely spectacular. So those flocks, you know, it seems that this was a case where one of those flocks, rather than being inspiring, something went awry.
Like it's like lemmings, maybe, that they followed these leaders, you know, to their death. These are really rare events when you see these birds just sort of come crashing out of the sky like that. But in 2020, in the desert southwest, there was an incident where researchers blamed wildfires and drought. Ultimately, they said it was climate change. And it makes me wonder if you think that we're due for more of these scenes.
Yeah, in this case, you know, seeing this many birds go into the ground all at once, to me, it suggests that there was some sort of disturbance involved. Back in 2010, 2011, there was a case, again, with blackbirds, where a number of them at a large roost in the middle of the night were frightened. They were disturbed by fireworks, and many of them collided with buildings, and there was a number of mortalities there. So to me, this looks like it was likely something that could have caused, you know, some sort of other disturbance, whether it was a predator or something else going on in the environment that caused these birds to collide into the ground.
So one of our producers, Jim Guthrie, had an amazing question that I don't think I would have thought of on my own, but he's just that smart. He said, you know, you look around and you see millions and millions of birds flying and doing their thing in the trees and waking you up in the morning, but you almost never see a dead one. But they all have to die. So where do they go when they die?
It's a really good observation. And it's one of the things that makes understanding bird conservation so tough is that we very infrequently find dead birds. And it's one of the things that's so, you know, really heartbreaking about this is that even though this is going on, it's not often that we're confronted with a graphic illustration of how easily birds can perish. You know, even something as simple as a bird running into a window, even that kind of collision can easily cause a bird to die. And that's one of the reasons that the Audubon Society and many others are working to reduce the risks that birds face in terms of collisions in the places that we live.
I can only imagine that a video like that would send, you know, your folks at the Audubon Society sort of into a grasping of pearls for starters, but then also an opportunity to study and try to find out more. I'm so thankful that you joined us tonight because I'm still completely flummoxed by this. Nat Seavey, thank you for your insight.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to know what you do know, that's for sure. Okay, I'm going to switch gears. Do you hate your job but need the money? What if you could still make that money, even while you're sleeping? After the break, I'm going to talk to three people who found a way to do just that, and it's something they love as well, and they're doing it full-time and making millions. Tomorrow on Morning in America, how do Americans really feel about immigration? Our exclusive News Nation poll, just about to release, gives some fresh insight as to where the public stands on this polarizing question. Welcome back. It is Wednesday. Hump day. Remember that commercial? You know, you're just so close to the weekend and yet so far from it. If you can just make it through the next 2 days, you can relax and have fun without thinking about all those expense reports on your desk or that manager who hovers or that mouth breather in the next cubicle. The sad truth is most Americans really don't like their jobs. A recent survey by Monster.com found that 95% of us think about quitting our jobs. 92% of us in the U.S., we say we wish that we were working in a totally different industry. And 60% of us already have our resignation letters written, present company excluded. I like this job. So this is why it's so surprising that we've, or not so surprising, I should say, that we've seen millions of people dumping their jobs, right? Every month they're doing it. Something called the Great Resignation. You probably have some family or friends who said, take this job and shove it. But where did they go? According to job experts, it varies. The majority have found new jobs that they like a little bit better. Some are still looking for work, but a select few have started their own businesses. And that last group has figured out how to take their side hustle, the thing that they're passionate about, and turn it into a full-time hustle that pays, and in some cases pays really big. Right after the break, I'm going to talk to three people who quit their jobs and are now making millions doing what they love. They're going to explain exactly how they did it and how you can too. And if you're ready to quit your job, I just wouldn't quit this show, not right now. I would wait till after the break because then you're going to get some really good information and quitting your job might actually make sense. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Do you have a side hustle? That's the thing that people do on the side to make a little extra money alongside their main source of income. For a lot of people, that side hustle is what they'd really rather be doing full time if it only paid enough. But is it possible to turn your passion project into something that does pay the bills and then some? My next three guests say, you're darn right. They all turned their side hustles into businesses, big businesses, and now they're pulling in millions. Kat Norton launched her company, Miss Excel, in 2020. She now has more than 1 million followers online and won the Microsoft MVP award. Steve Chu and his wife started their company, Bumblebee Linens, in 2007, and he now teaches other people how to launch their own companies on his very popular blog, My Wife Quit Her Job. And Tori Gerbig turned her eBay side hustle into the company Pink Lily, and last year it brought in $141 million, and that's no joke. Thank you all three for being here. Tori, I'm going to start with you. 141 mil. Ooh, that's a lot. How easy is this? I mean, everybody watching right now is thinking, I'm going to quit tomorrow. This sounds like a cakewalk. How easy is it to really just quit your job and then be a millionaire?
Okay, it's not as easy as it sounds, but it was something that, you know, we look back on and we're like, wow, that actually did happen, you know? So, it took a lot of hard work and dedication, but we were really passionate about what we did. And, here we are 8 years later. And like you said, $141 million in sales last year. So it's insane. But again, a lot of hard work goes into it.
So Kat, you were, already kind of doing what you're doing now. You didn't do a side hustle that was so different than your regular hustle. You were teaching people all about Microsoft Excel, hence the name Miss Excel. And you basically said, I think I can just do this on TikTok. This will be fun. Little tiny videos on TikTok that blew up into the business you're doing now. Walk me a little further into that story.
Absolutely. So it was June of 2020, when I first put out Excel tip videos on TikTok to trending songs and music, and the whole thing quickly went viral, and it's since grown to over 1 million followers across the platforms.
And then also big businesses saw this and said, you know what, she's onto something here. Let's bring her in to teach our, you know, workers how to use these Microsoft products. And is that where the big money started flowing in?
For me, it was really in course sales. So within 12 months, I scaled it to a 7-figure course sales business. And I also do corporate trainings and motivational speaking and things like that as well.
Okay, so Steve, you and your wife, as I understand it, started Bumblebee Linens, making custom handkerchiefs, aprons, and towels, which was doing really well. But now you're going even further and teaching people how to do what you did, how to start their own companies and, you know, get part of the great resignation under their belt and still make money. How easy is it?
So first off, I know this is the wrong segment, Ashley, but I just want to say that you look amazing. And to answer your question.
You're so sweet. Thank you. I'm going to be paying you for that. So clearly you figured out another side hustle.
So, you know, as I believe Tori said, it is not easy, but I would say it's more to be successful. It's more about being persistent rather than, you know, you don't really need to be super smart to pull it off. You just need to persevere through all the obstacles that you face.
So, Tori, when you have a side hustle that you love and you can't stand your job and then you make your job your side hustle, the big question for a lot of people is, am I still going to love my side hustle when it becomes my everyday? I've got to do it. And if I don't do it really well, I can't pay the bills and the mortgage. Is it still fun?
Yeah, I mean, I still wake up and I love my job. We actually just got back from Tulum yesterday. We were shooting our spring line and I'm more passionate than ever about what I do. I feel like now that I don't have a full-time corporate job, I can really like focus and put my heart and soul into my business and my brand. So I truly do wake up every day loving what I do.
Yeah, there's something about just not having some, you know, guy or girl, you know, breathing down your neck and telling you what you have to be and what you have to do. That's pretty, I don't know, liberating. Okay, so Kat, you three all have a couple of traits that I think you share. You're dedicated, you're disciplined, you're gregarious. Not everybody has that. So do you have advice for people out there that maybe not everybody is geared to, you know, say goodbye to the steady paycheck and go it on their own?
I'd say my biggest piece of advice would be to take messy action. So oftentimes we are the only ones really standing in our own way from taking that next step and diving into your side hustle. And just remembering that nothing has to be perfect. That was one of my biggest learning lessons along the way and what really allowed me to scale the business so quickly.
I love that. Do messy things because that, no, life is messy. And, you know, if you don't make a few messes, you're not going to figure out what clean looks like. Steve, if you could go back, do you spot mistakes in launching this new side of your life with your wife? Could you do things differently? Can you spot things and help people leapfrog things you wish you hadn't done?
Yeah. You know, so my advice to everyone really would be to just solve your own problems. The reason why we decided to sell handkerchiefs online, it's because my wife knew that she was going to cry at our wedding. And just to be straight up with you all, if I knew that I was going to be spending the rest of my life with me, I'd probably start crying too. But we ended up looking all over the place for hankies and couldn't find any. But then we found this factory and then decided to start selling them because we couldn't find them anywhere. So just scratch your own itch.
Yeah, find a need that's not being made, you're met out there. I hear that all the time. Find a need that's not being met and then just go after it, be messy and be diligent and persevere. All right, so Tori, we said a few times leading up to this segment, you can make money while you sleep. And it sounds like an infomercial, but you're really doing it. Like you're making money while you sleep. It's not so far-fetched, is it?
No, absolutely not. That's the one thing I've listened to podcasts and I listen to, you know, these big motivational speakers, and they always say that's the key to really making it is to make money while you sleep. So you can create a brand, you can start a business that is going to just continue to earn money while you're sleeping. It's possible.
Yep. I literally need all three products that you guys offer. So I'll be calling you in the commercial break to, you know, get some, you know, appointment on the books because I know you're busy, especially, you know, booking trips to Tulum and shoots and all the rest. I wish I lived your life. Hey, all three of you, thank you. Really appreciate that. That was great. Kat Norton, Steve Chu, and Tori Gerbig, and I wish you wonderful successes in the future, too.
Thank you.
And Steve, you look really good as well. I wanted to make sure you knew that. Hey, by the way, this brings us to the trivia question for tonight. How many businesses do you think were launched in the U.S. during the pandemic? Because remember, we all had so much time on our hands, right? We were in quarantine. This number is going to be pretty interesting to you. We're going to give it to you in just a minute. Okay, before the break, I asked you tonight's trivia question because remember, we were all stuck at home. We got sick of looking at ourselves on Zoom. We got tired of Zoom meetings. We started craving like some kind of personal interaction. And some of us decided, you know what? Screw this. I'm going to do my own thing. So how many businesses were started in the United States during the pandemic? The answer is, wait for it, 9.8 million. Are you kidding me? Almost 10 million. Here's how it breaks down. There were a record 5.4 million applications to start a business in 2021 and 4.4 million in 2020. And the entrepreneurs aren't slowing down either. Just last month, another 430,000 businesses were started. Now might be the time if you're thinking about doing it. Just don't forget, you got to get out of bed. No one's going to be making you hit the clock. So you got to do it. You got to incorporate. You got to be good with administration. Think it through. And then here's what's most important. Persevere. Persevere. Be patient. You can do it. We got you. Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for watching tonight. We're back here at 10 p.m., 9 Central. See you tomorrow.